The Holy Gospel according to St. Mark, the 7th chapter. Then Jesus returned from the region of Tyre and went by way of Sidon towards the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. They brought to him a deaf man who had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. Jesus took him aside in private, away from the crowd, and put his fingers into his ears, and he spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, "Ephphatha," that is, "be opened." And immediately his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. Then Jesus ordered them to tell no one, but the more he ordered them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. They were astounded beyond measure, saying, "He has done everything well. He even makes the deaf to hear and the mute to speak." The Gospel of the Lord. Twelve years ago this coming week, my wife and I received a phone call from a social worker in Cleveland, Ohio. She informed us that on Tuesday, there had been a little boy born at Cleveland Metro Hospital in downtown Cleveland, and that the agency wanted to place this boy in our home for adoption. We were delighted and thrilled. We'd already picked out the name. Andrew Timothy was going to be his name. On Friday, we got in the car. We drove to Cleveland. We went to the hospital, and we picked up this beautiful little boy. When we first saw him, as many of you have heard me say, there are three things I remember about him. Number one is that he had this furrowed brow as he sort of studied us, like, what am I in for the rest of my life? He had formula dripping out of the corner of his mouth, and he had the hiccups. Those are the first images I have of my son, and he has just brought such joy to us ever since. We took him home. My mother-in-law was waiting in the driveway when we arrived home. We had some wonderful time with her, and around 9 o'clock, when it was time for my wife and I to go to bed, we figured this new baby in our house would follow the family routine. And so we take him to the nursery, and we kiss him goodnight, and we lay him in the crib, and we go over and lay in our bed, and about 30 to 45 seconds later, we hear this wailing from the nursery. It wasn't going to happen that way. He has been strong-willed from the very beginning and continues to be that way, and it will serve him well when he's an adult, but it makes it a wonderful challenge to be his parents. It was then that it dawned on us that when someone new comes into our lives must change. For someone new to come into our lives must change. In the Gospel of Mark, in chapters 7 and 8, we have two feeding stories. Chapter 7, we have the feeding of the 5,000. In chapter 8, we have the feeding of the 4,000. Now, usually the feeding of the 5,000 gets more attention because more people got fed, so it's more sensational. People pay attention to things that are more sensational. But what is fascinating is if you take a look at what Mark puts in between the stories of the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. in between the two stories is the story of what is known as the Syrophoenician woman. That is a Gentile, an outsider, someone impure, unclean, unacceptable to those of the Jewish faith. If you want to grasp hold of how that felt for a good Jew, think of those people in your own life for whom you have no regard, that repulse you, that you don't want to even look at, let alone think about. This woman approaches Jesus and announces to Jesus that her daughter is possessed with a demon and asks Jesus to cast out the demon. Jesus responds to the woman by saying, "Why would we take the food from God's people and give it to the dogs?" And the woman looks back at Jesus and says, "But even the dogs eat the scraps that fall from the master's table." And Jesus looks at her and says, "I admire your faith. Because of your faith, your daughter will be healed." And we hear from Mark that the little girl, the demon, disappeared from her and she was made whole. So what happens between the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000 is that this unclean, unacceptable woman is declared by Jesus to be clean and acceptable in the eyes of God. That's important to note, for when the 5,000 were fed, they were all Jews. And if you look at the story, it's the prayer that Jesus uses over the bread before the miracle is a good Jewish prayer. The leftovers are 12 baskets, similar to the 12 tribes of Israel. But the feeding of the 4,000 is the feeding of 4,000 Gentiles, of 4,000 outsiders. And the leftovers are 7 baskets, which is a key number in Greek society. And the prayer that Jesus uses is a generalized prayer from the Greek culture. And so what we see is the 5,000 is given to God's people. The 4,000 fed are people who once were outcasts and unclean. Jesus has declared that all people are clean and acceptable in the eyes of God. The role of the faith community is to engage those people and welcome them into their midst, even if their lives must be changed. Jesus encounters then the story of the deaf man with a speech impediment. I say that slowly so I don't actually have an impediment when I say speech impediment. That story also falls between the story of the two feedings. And what we hear is that after this man has his ears open wide and after this man's tongue is released and he can speak plainly, Jesus orders them to tell no one, but the more he orders them, it's sort of like my son, the more I tell him no, the more he does what he's not supposed to do. The more Jesus orders them, the more zealously they proclaim what Jesus has done. Now, we can get at why is Jesus wanting to keep this a secret, but we can also take a look at why Mark does what Mark does when he writes the gospel. And when Mark puts in stories like this, Mark is making a point of comparison. And what Mark is doing is comparing the response of this man who has been healed with Jesus' disciples. And every time Jesus has ordered his disciples to go out and proclaim the word and do God's will, they don't do it. And yet here's the outsider, the unclean man, who is going out and doing the will of God. What Mark does is put them side by side to show us that too many times, those who claim to be closest to God and disciples of Jesus are not doing the work of their Lord, which is the work a welcoming into the community of faith every person, every child loved by God. We can take a look at what some of the traps are for the faith community in not being engaged in that life of proclamation. One of the traps is we limit evangelism to membership evangelism. That is, our goal is to get more members, because after all, we love it when the pews are filled, and every preacher who's preached here would tell you it's more exciting to preach when the pews are filled as opposed to when there's just a handful of people out there. It changes the spirit and the energy of the place. And there'll be those who will say, we need more members so we can pay the bills. That's membership evangelism. But notice then the standard it sets for what makes a good member. A good member, then, is someone who will be a good giver. And then we fall into the trap of the second lesson, which is the partiality we show to those who are rich and not to those who are poor. It also then leads us to sit here and wait for people to come to us instead of engaging them in the Word of God wherever we encounter them in our lives. So membership evangelism can be one of those traps that keeps us from proclaiming. Likewise, understanding the church as a place where we learn what are the right ethics by which we should live becomes a trap. As soon as we diminish the faith community to simply a place that gives us good ethics, the next step is that we will divide along political lines. And so there will be those Christians who align with the progressive agenda, and there'll be those Christians who align with the conservative agenda. And then the church divides the same way the government has divided. How effective is that right now? So what happens is you have those who are progressive, who in their arrogance think that they are more enlightened than anyone else. And we have those who are conservative, who think that they are better than the rest. There's this smugness about them because they get the rules right. And on both sides, then, the concern is about being right, not doing what is right. If the church is more concerned about being right than doing what is right, then the church isn't a place of ethics, is it? It's about pushing one's own agenda, and we become the very thing we try not to be. It's a trap we can fall into. We can fall into the trap to think that the church is a place that serves those in need. But you can feed the hungry. You can give shoes to those who are homeless. You can help find housing to those who need places to live. You can do that without being a Christian. And so you start living out works without faith. And I dare say that this congregation fell into that trap almost a decade ago, that social ministry became more important than the worship life of the church. And I'm delighted to see us moving away from that, that worship is the central act of the church, because that's where God is revealed to us through word and sacrament. And when God comes to us, God transforms our lives, gives us our Christ-like character, so we can go forth then and do what is right. Another trap we can get into is forgetting the place of our children and young people in worship. About 2 years ago, I was at the Chautauqua Institute, and I decided to attend Sunday worship at the Lutheran House at Chautauqua. And as I was greeting the pastor who was leading the service, he asked where I was from. I said, Lancaster, Holy Trinity in Lancaster. And this is what the pastor said to me. He said, oh, that's the church where the ushers stand at the front door and they send the kids one way and the adults the other way, because kids aren't supposed to be in church. a reputation this congregation had. Maybe still does. But think about what you do when you see a child or hear a child do something that causes you to pay attention to them in worship. Do you glare? Do you roll your eyes and whisper to the person next to you and point? Or do you give thanks to God that those children and young people are in worship? We get stuck with the language that the children are the future of our church, and that is wrong. The children are the church now. God is the future of the church. When I finished my call in Ohio, they roasted me my last Sunday and invited people to come forward. And I'd forgotten I'd even done this, but one person came forward and said, our first time to worship at Living Lord was on Christmas Eve. And we had our son who was autistic, and whenever there's large crowds and noise, he gets nervous. And what he does is he starts to breathe loudly. And he said what happened was he was doing that during the sermon, and we started to notice everyone starting to stare at us. He said, and then all of a sudden you stopped the sermon and you looked at the congregation and you said, if you're not ready for that child to break into your lives tonight, perhaps you're not ready for the Christ child to break into your lives either. Because God interrupts our lives and expects us to be different because God changes us. We can be like the disciples of Jesus, commanded to proclaim and yet ever so reluctant to do it. Some of you may know or may have heard that for about the last 9 months, I've been having some health difficulties. Most of those difficulties are related to breathing for me. It put me in the hospital in January. It put me in the hospital back in July again. And so I'm thankful for wonderful doctors in my life who continue to work with me and continue to strive to find ways to deal with what is happening. But I also have learned, first of all, that breathing is very important. If you don't believe me, hold your breath and see what happens. You'll find out how important it is. But I also have learned to recognize a bit more about what my body does. And so at those moments when I notice my anxiety level going up, I now realize it's because I'm probably struggling to breathe. And then I need to treat that. And when the breathing opens up, then the anxiety level goes down. Now, being a pastor doesn't bring anxiety, and certainly not being the senior pastor at Trinity doesn't bring anxiety into one's life. But the Hebrew word for anxiety is literally to grab hold of someone else's neck and choke the breath out of them. And if you think about those times when your anxiety level is high, you can be aware of how difficult it is to breathe. And we are in a highly anxious time in the time of the church. We are worried about our future. We are worried about our well-being. And we look for what will make it better. Here's a problem I fall into, is that my coping mechanism for anxiety is to go running. But right now, I can't. So I don't have the mechanism I need to deal with my anxiety. What is it that the church holds on to, thinking it's going to make the anxiety go away? Membership evangelism? Service ministry? We too hold on to all of those techniques we think are going to solve our problem. The Hebrew word for salvation is literally to open up. It is literally to move one's hands away from the neck so that someone can breathe, to make room for the breath of life. And our breath of life comes from Jesus Christ. Notice what he does before he heals the deaf man. He sighs. And then, with that breath of life, the man is healed. God is removing that stranglehold from your own lives, giving you the space to breathe, and calling you to tell others about who is Lord of salvation. That is our calling as a congregation, to be willing at this moment to proclaim what God is doing and be willing to change our lives so that we can welcome into our midst those who are different but who are beloved children of God. Amen.